HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Hey there, welcome to the Linda McKenzie Show. This week, let's remember, when one door closes, look for the new door to open. Our guest today is Elaine Kosrova, and she's author of a great book. It's called Butter. I was absolutely charmed by this book, and I had to have her on. I'll also be giving you lots of fun and information, as well as doing some God-based psychic readings later on in the show. But right now, let's get to our guest. We have Elaine Kosrova, and she's author of Butter. Now, Elaine is a college trained in food and nutrition. She was a pastry student chef at the Culinary Institute of America and is in food publishing for several prestigious magazines. And she's also the founding editor of Culture, a magazine about cheese. Welcome, Elaine.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Oh, Elaine, I thought this book was charming. I have not, you know, I interview a lot of people after being 20 years in radio, right? And I always love it, and I'm an author myself, and I always love it when someone comes up with this wonderful thing that's right before our eyes and we know nothing about it.
Yes.
And that's what your book does, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it is remarkable that there's no other book on butter. Certainly not for the consumer. You know, there's some trade manuals on making butter, but yeah, this has been overlooked for a really long time, and yet, you know, it's universally loved. So I'm really happy to kind of fill that void.
Well, you did a good job, I can tell you that. So tell us a little bit about the beginning of the butter trip.
Well, you know, the history of butter dates back, you know, we can't even know precisely, but anywhere between 10 and 15,000 years ago. Because we can pretty much align it with when people started domesticating animals, and that would have been sheep and goats and yak. Cows were domesticated much later, so the early butters we wouldn't recognize at all. They were quite different because they came from a different kind of milk. So that's really where, you know, the history of butter begins. My own personal butter trip kind of started with a butter tasting that I did several years ago. Because up until that point, I was taking butter for granted like everyone else, even though I'd always baked with it, you know, had it in my kitchen. But I did this butter tasting of about 12 different brands, and they were domestic and imported. And when you see butter brands laid out together, you know, side by side, you really can see the nuances in this product, you know, the colors, the texture, the aroma, the flavor. I was really, really very surprised. It was no different than, you know, doing a flight of, you know, say Pinot Noirs or something like that, where, wow, these are really different. So that's kind of, that piqued my interest, was, you know, the craft and science of butter making to give us these nuances. And from there, I discovered the history. And at that point, I was like, okay, this is a book.
Yeah. Well, I can imagine, because I use different kinds of, it's crazy, but I've used different kinds of butter for different kinds of things. And I use, you know, Irish grass-fed butter for certain things. I always use organic butter. I don't like mm-hmm. the regular mm-hmm. stuff. I mean, I can't eat it. And there's a different taste to it. You know, there's just a different taste. I can remember as a kid, though, I grew up in Staten Island, New York, in New York City. And we had this place called Richmond Town, right? And what they did was they, back in the day, and of course I'm almost 70, so that was way back in the day, you know, they had us go in and they took this old wooden butter churn, and we all had to take turns churning the butter. Yeah, and it was really kind of fun. It was like a colonial day type thing. And so it was always a lot of fun. And we get to taste that butter, too. We had little crackers or whatever that we tasted the butter that we did. So maybe somewhere down there when I, you know, back in the day, and then I see your book and it reminded me of that pleasant experience, I said, oh, no, I have to have her on. So here we are.
Yeah, so you could relate to some of the stories in the book that are specifically about, you know, making butter by hand.
Yeah, yeah. Tell us about the early churning.
Well, the very early churnings, well, first of all, the first one, if we can imagine that there was a first one, prehistoric times, was inside a sack made from an animal skin that was, say, in the process of being transported over a mountain or valley or something like that, where it naturally rocked back and forth, and so it was essentially churned. So that's how we surmise, you know, the first butters came to be, by accident. And then for quite a long time, butter really never moved out of that skin, that animal skin, even though people were making it intentionally now. But they would essentially hang it from a tripod of sticks and then just rock it back and forth, kind of like a cradle. So that's the very early turns. And then we progressed to terracotta containers, you know, with a stick for churning, and then the really classic plunger churn, which is essentially just wooden pieces, you know, like a little barrel, essentially, a skinny barrel.
Yeah, that's what we used.
Right. That's the most primitive. And it's still being used in many parts of the world. In the Himalayas, for instance, they still use this very primitive type of churn. My book covers, you know, from the very beginning, you know, the animal skin churn all the way up to the modern churns, which can put out now 22,000 pounds of butter per hour, you know, fully automated. So there's quite a scope. And I find it kind of delightful that 21st century butter includes both of those things. It's true that, you know, butter is made primitively and it's made industrially in this enormous capacity. And so we can kind of honor both of those stories right now in this century.
Wow. You know, I'm reading some things, some of the fun facts about, and it's called Butter, A Rich History, you know, by Elaine Korsova. And in it is, I'll just read it. It says, the ancient Egyptians used butter mixed with sawdust as a paste to line the skin of mummies in order to plump the flesh and make it more lifelike. It had a similar effect to modern Botox.
Yeah, supposedly.
Wow.
Yeah, never really know for sure. There's lots of fun factoids like that in the book. In fact, I collected pages and pages of them, and I really wanted them, you know, dotted throughout the book.
Oh, they're
great. I only
got
about half of them in because there was just page constraints. So I hope to get my blog up and running soon and have more of those factoids out there because they are really fun.
Oh, they're just fun, really. So now, how did women build the butter trade?
Well, they built it because dairying and processing the milk, you know, making butter, making cheese, milking the animals, that was taboo in most cultures around the world. Let me clarify that. It was taboo for men to be involved in the dairy arts because it was so closely related to fertility and lactation and birthing, things that were so much in the feminine domain. So I discovered that across many cultures, you know, there was this prohibition against men doing these tasks. And so it came to women to do it, and they had monopoly on dairying and milking and certainly butter making and cheese making. And through that work, they really gained some status from this these tasks because butter and cheese were so valuable. You know, they were a great commodity, and many farms lived off of the revenue from butter and cheese making, and yet women controlled it entirely. So it gave them a real measure of status that was unusual back in the day. And, you know, that continued from, you know, really prehistoric times almost throughout most of the 1800s, you know, by the end of the 1800s, it had started to shift because of the Industrial Revolution, and men were getting much more involved in shifting the whole production of milk processing and butter making. But for all of those centuries, millennia, women were in charge of it. So it was very much built on the shoulders of hardy women around the world.
Well, that's a good thing. Now, what are some of the vintage butter-making tools and techniques that were used? Any kind of fun ones? I mean, we talked a little bit about the tools.
Well, I was fascinated to discover that within the 1800s, there was 80 different now I'm messing up the statistic. It's something. It's an enormous amount of butter patents, butter churn patents that were developed. Something like every 10 days there was another patent issued from the U.S. Patent Office throughout the 1800s. So there were all kinds of variations on essentially agitating cream, because that's really butter making that's what it is. That's what it amounts to, is just agitating cream. And some of the more, you know, beautiful tools I found were the molds that women use to, you know, form their butter, because, you know, not only they were making it, they were also marketing it. It was their job to take it to market. And so each farmhouse had their own proprietary butter mold, hand-carved, you know, with their own particular design, so it branded their butter. And those are real collectibles these days. I have quite a few of them. So there are many, you know, there are lots of tools I discovered by meeting up with this particular butter enthusiast. His name is Sandeep Agarwal, and he's a man from New Jersey who, in his spare time, collects lots of butter paraphernalia from all around the world. He has a write about this storage unit that he has in New Jersey that's full of these butter equipment treasures. And he, you know, repairs them, and he polishes them, and he looks up their history. So I was able to visit him and see many different kinds of churns, and also things called butter workers, which was, they were used to take the butter once it's freshly made and then work the butter to get some of the liquid out and add salt and essentially create a really nice cohesive texture to the butter.
Wow.
So those are just some of the tools, you know, again, that are in my book you can read about.
Right. There's a lot of stuff in here about butter. You would never think there was a lot of information about butter. You know, I do want to interject that, you know, during the, you know, sometimes they, you know, Western medicine is a little nuts in their head, you know, so, you know, because, you know, at one time they say, well, you can't eat butter, you know, because butter is bad for your system. However, there's always been an enzyme in butter, in pure butter, that is good for your heart. So, you know, you can't listen. It's like the eggs are good this year and then they're not. Then you can eat the yolk and then you can't eat the albumin. You know, I don't believe that anything's here on this planet that, you know, if we do everything in moderation, it's not going to be good for us one way or another, you know, except for the poisons, but you don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. So, but, you know, having owned a vitamin shop and a vitamin company, manufacturing company and things, you know, you really have to be really careful. One of the things is I can't believe it's not butter and all this other stuff and stuff. Yeah. You do not want to touch. It's either GMO or it's really bad for you, and you know, you're better off with real butter, which is one of the reasons and one of the mission I wanted to talk to Elaine today, to educate people on butter, because it's really very healthy for you. Don't listen to the Western medicine. You know, natural medicine has been around for thousands of years. Western medicine, maybe 150, maybe even that. All right, let's take a look about men and the margarine battles. And butter cannons. What in the world is a butter cannon?
Yeah, that picks up on, you know, the story that I started to say before, when men became involved in the late 1800s in butter making. And then it was all about production and making more and making more, because butter at that point was a really great commodity, you know, really, really valuable commodity. So, you saw this industrialization. Two things happened. You had a cream separator was invented, and that allows people for the first time to have truly fresh cream, because up until that time, they had to leave the milk out for many hours, 12, 24 hours, which allowed the cream to rise to the top, and then they skimmed it off and made butter from that. And during that process, the cream would ferment slightly with lactic bacteria that were naturally present. You know, this was not anything bad with the butter, but it always developed a little bit of tanginess, or sometimes a lot of tanginess. I mean, there was a lot of very over-ripened butter back in the day. So the cream separator came along and just changed things overnight, because suddenly you could put cream in this machine, or put milk in this machine, and separate the cream out from the more liquid portion. So about the same time, margarine came on the scene too, and partly because there was so much bad butter on the market, particularly in America. America had a pretty lousy reputation for their butter. A lot of rancid butter, moldy butter, dirty butter, butter that was cheated with, sometimes they put rocks and things in them to give it more weight. So margarine came along as an answer that was, you know, more affordable. It was made from natural ingredients, in fact, from beef fat and milk and a little natural food coloring and salt. So it actually wasn't is a product that, you know, in the 1900s was full of trans fats that was bad for you. The first margarine, I don't know what it tasted like, but it was quite different from the margarines that we know. But these things came along, again, right before the 1900s began and just changed the butter market completely.
Are you there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, and then, yeah. So what was a butter cannon? That's the one I didn't.
Oh, the butter cannon. There is a photo of that in my book. That is one of those high, you know, high production industrial churns that I was referring to earlier that makes 22,000 pounds of butter per hour. And that's what the French named it. They called it, you know, butter cannon in their language. And it actually looks like a cannon. You'll see a photo of it in my book. It just looks like it, you know, would shoot out butter, which is what it does, essentially.
All right. And now, what is the difference between molecular butter and, tell us a little bit about molecular butter and modern buttersmiths.
Yeah, the chapter in my book that is titled Molecular Butter really refers to understanding butter at a molecular level, you know, what's really in this thing that, you know, we love that's, you know, so flavorful and also so versatile in the kitchen. So I really try to help people understand how complex it is. It has about 120 different flavor compounds, for one thing.
Wow.
And some of them we can't detect until butter is melted, which is why, you know, warm toast with warm butter is so much better than toast, cold toast with cold butter. You really get, like, the full sensory experience.
Right.
Partly because you have these interesting compounds that need a little temperature to be released. So I wanted people to understand that and kind of marvel about that, and also the composition of butter for a butter maker, if you're interested in making butter, how important it is to understand that the cream is composed of solid and liquid fats. And you want just the right ratio of those fats to get the best texture in butter. This is why I love looking at the textures of butter, because that's a really tricky thing. If you have cream that has too much liquid fat, you end up with a kind of greasy butter. And conversely, if you have too much hard fat, you have a more brittle butter. And I find when people make butter at home, you know, it's delicious, it's wonderful, it's fun to make. But we often end up with either of those extremes, a butter that's a little too greasy or too loose, or one that's a bit more brittle, not so cohesive like you would find the butters in the supermarket. You know, in the industrial production, when the cream comes into the plant, they temper it, which means they put it through this temperature process. There's not anything bad. It's a very subtle. It's a very subtle change from warm to cold and cold to warm to shift this composition of hard and soft fats, and that's how we are able to enjoy that beautiful cohesive butter in the supermarket. So that's a lot of what that chapter is about, you know, the chemical structure of butter.
Right. In your book, you also give a lot of recipes, and you tell different ways of making different kinds of butter, and you actually even recommend different kinds of butter from different kinds of worlds. There's so much in this book. It's unbelievable. Can you stay with us for another segment?
Yes.
Okay. All right. We're going to take a break, and we're going to be right back with Elaine Kosrova and her book, Butter, which you can get at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any bookstore, and if they don't have it, you can order it. It's a fun book, especially if you know somebody that cooks, or even if you don't, it's just a really great universal read. We'll be right back.
Inspiration and motivation is just a podcast away. At hrnradio.com.
Hey there, welcome back. You're listening to the Linda McKenzie Show. We have with us Elaine Kosrova, and we're talking about her book called Butter, A Rich History. What's your website, Elaine?
I'm sorry to say, I'm working on a blog, putting together a blog with a lot of videos and things from my research, and it's not quite ready yet.
Oh, okay, that's okay. So, but they can get where they can get the book from Amazon and in bookstores, and they can order it anywhere they can, right?
Yeah, many independent bookstores have it because my publisher has a good relationship with those stores. So I would encourage them to support their local bookstores and get it there or ask them to order it.
Right. And the name, let me spell Elaine's last name. It's K-H-O-S, R as in Ralph, O, V as in Victor, A, Khosrova. And the name of the book is called Butter, A Rich History. So now we're going to get into the touchy-feely kinds of things about butter. And no, I don't mean we can put it on our stuff or, you know, our faces or whatever. But give us some of the tips on how to work with butter as a cooking ingredient, because you are, you know, a great chef. So, and in the book, there's great recipes, too, even for butterscotch candy. I can't wait to try that one. Anyway, so tell us a little bit how to work with butter as a cooking ingredient.
Well, one of the things that I find so remarkable about butter is its relationship to temperature. You know, when we work with it in the kitchen, if it's softened, we can make, you know, cookie doughs and frostings and, you know, things like that. And then if it's hard and cold, we can make beautiful pastries, you know, pie pastry or puff pastry, croissants. And then if it's melted, we can do, you know, all these different kinds of sauces. So, when you think of butter in those terms, as how versatile it is just based on its reaction to temperature, I don't think there's any other ingredient that can claim that. I really have thought long and hard. I find butter to be, you know, so versatile. It goes sweet, it goes savory, it can work with spicy things. So that's one just appreciation of butter. And then as far as using it, I, like you, I keep several different butters on hand. I like a high-fat butter, which would mean one that has 82% butterfat or more, and oftentimes the label will say European-style butter, and that means it's 82% butterfat, because in Europe that's the legal standard for butter. In the States, it's only 80%. So this higher-fat butter is much easier to work with, in my opinion. It's much more foolproof as far as having, you know, great flaky pastry. I'm a real pie fan. I make a lot of pie.
Right.
I just love it. So
I have a quick question. So is the butter from years ago, like say in the 50s when I was growing up, was that more of an 82% than these days, or do you even know on that?
I doubt it. I doubt it, because every percentage point more, they're losing money.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
It's because there's no water in it.
You know,
there's less water.
And we are American. We are American. We like that American dollar. Shame on them.
Exactly.
Okay, that answered a good question too. We got to start taking some of the money out of the good stuff, you know, and bring back the love and the stuff, and get out a little bit of this corporate capitalism and kind of a little bit embrace each other and support each other.
But I will say, I think the 80% butter works really well in certain applications, like making cookies, but also cakes. That whipping, that creaming process. If you're a cake baker and you do that creaming process with sugar and butter, I think that little bit of extra water in the butter helps create a little more loft in the cake, a few more air pockets.
That makes sense.
I think it's good we have the choice, actually. You know, now we have the choice. We didn't back in the 50s, but now you can go find the high-fat butter for what you want it for.
Right. So that's great. So there is a big difference in working with it, again, in temperature. So, for example, if you're going to do pastries and pie crusts, you want it to be cold. If you want to do cakes or cookies, you want it to be room temperature, right?
Yes. Absolutely, yeah. And if you forgot to leave your butter out, you know, and you need it softened, if you have a little bit of time, just cut it up into small pieces, and it'll actually soften very quickly.
Right.
But if you're really trying to do it right then and there, I do use the defrost setting on my microwave just for like 8 seconds.
Right.
And then I shift the butter and, you know, do another 8 seconds. But you have to be super careful with that. But it does work.
Right, right. Well, sometimes I do that because I'm, you know, sugar-free and kind of dairy-free. But the only thing I eat in dairy is, well, I have goat cheese, but the only thing I eat is butter. I cook with butter and eggs because those are two good things. Now,
the fats and butter are really, really good for you. And you don't have the more allergic parts of dairy in butter. So it's good for most people. Even people that are lactose intolerant can have butter with no problem at all.
Right. Now, the other thing that really surprised me is that it's, although cows are the most common source of milk for butter, throughout history, butter was also made from many different things. What kind of butter? Can you name some of those? I know that there's not only sheep and goat, but there's camel butter.
Right, camel butter, reindeer butter. It's this category of ruminant animals is quite a big category. It includes, you know, yak and reindeer and goat and sheep, water buffalo. So all of these animals give milk that can theoretically and actually have been turned into butter. It's not always practical. Certainly, reindeer give very little milk.
you got to catch them first, you know.
Yeah. So it doesn't really make sense. But I have tried. I traveled a lot for this book because I wanted to experience some of those butters firsthand.
Did you?
I was in Bhutan where I was able to make yak butter, fresh yak butter, and try that, as well as in India. I had water buffalo butter.
Wow.
That was one of the best butters I've ever had.
Really?
Water buffalo butter.
Really?
Yeah.
So I
wouldn't say that people should expect that uniformly of any water buffalo butter that you would encounter.
Right, right.
Because I've had some that weren't so good, but the one in India is made by a process of like slow fermentation of the milk, and it was absolutely delicious.
Wow. So that's interesting that the tastes are, is it similar or are they saltier, tangier, spicier, or is it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. Well, and a lot of those qualities you just mentioned, it really depends on what the butter maker chooses to do. Certainly with salt, none of the butters are naturally salty. So it's a question of how much salt is added. Whether or not it's more tangy or more buttery tasting often has to do with whether or not the cream has been fermented slightly or inoculated with certain bacteria to get that tanginess and to also improve the quantity of what's called diacetyl. Diacetyl is a natural compound, but it's that thing that makes butter buttery. If you can imagine really buttery popcorn that you can buy, that's not very nice. it's artificial or it can be naturally produced, but diacetyl is responsible for that buttery flavor. So I found a huge variation in the butters that I tasted around the world, particularly goat and sheep butters, which have a much more of an animal taste, almost a meatiness that I find in their taste. I can, you can distinguish a goat butter pretty quickly.
Right, right.
And we have access to many of these butters in this country. You have to hunt them down, like in small food shops or online or go to farmers markets. But it's really interesting to try all these different butters.
Oh, that's great. Well, I just want to say again, let's tell everybody where they can find out more about you and get your book.
Yes, well, you can get my book at your local bookstore, hopefully, and if they don't have it, then I'm sure they can order it from Algonquin Press. I'm also on Twitter at Butterdishing is my handle. So I've involved in sort of butter conversations around that. And when my blog is up, people will hear about it through Twitter as well.
Oh, that's great. And again, they can get this on Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
So we can get this wonderful book called Elaine Kasarova's Her Butter, A Rich History. And I certainly like the recipes in the back. And then you have a really good appendix in the back about a little bit of the different countries. One of the things I think that people might want to understand, which is probably a butter question that most people don't ask, is what is the difference between butter and ghee?
Right. Well, that's a good question, yes. because ghee is also becoming much more prevalent in our shops, and people should know it's quite a healthy cooking fat. I use it for many different stews, and if I'm even making scrambled eggs, things like that, I use it because from a culinary point of view, it has a higher smoke point, so you can bring it to a much higher temperature than butter. And the reason that is because what ghee is and how it's made is by taking butter and melting it down and then letting it simmer for quite a while. So any of the water, remember we said butter has about 20% water, you want to drive off that water and then turn it off. And then at that point, the solids in the butter, which are mostly proteins, they collect on the bottom of your pot. And then what you're left with is this nice pool of butter oil.
Right. So, and then you have to skim. You got to skim the top, right, because there's a the white, because I've made my own ghee. Well, anyway, I want to thank you. We're out of time, but Elaine, thank you for writing this book.
Thank you for your enthusiasm about it. I appreciate it very much.
All right, then. Well, we're going to come right back. Get Elaine Kosarova's book, Butter, A Rich History, Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, or your favorite bookstore. We'll be right back.
Environmentally sound for your mind. HRNradio.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Linda McKenzie Show. You know, I believe everything and everyone has value. And nothing gives me greater joy than helping people. My primary goal is that I want you to feel good in body, mind, and spirit. And I want you to know that I'm here to help you do that. Now it's time to do some psychic readings for you. This is where I get to help you. Limit your question to one so I can get to each one of you. And give me a call at 800-555-5453 or 310-371-5444. Let's get to Todd in West Virginia. Hi, Todd.
Hey. All right. Since I'm a year older now, I just had a birthday last Friday. What is my year going to be like this year? Give me my yearly objection.
Okay, great. Objective, not an objection. We're not going to object to anything happening to you this year because it's actually going to be a very, very good year for you. Basically, what I'm seeing is they're going to do some adjustment on medication that you're taking, and it's going to make you feel a lot better, and you don't have to worry about continuing on. There's some new developments that are coming that are going to make you feel better, and you will be pretty healthy, so you don't have to worry in that department if you were worrying. There's a new group of people that will be coming around in the March, April time frame, and it may have something to do with hiking or outdoors, doing some kind of activity, which I know sometimes you don't do, but you might want to take a look in that direction. They're a nice group of people. There's a new church group somewhere that you might join around in September. A lot of dancing, a lot of fun, and a lot of spirituality this year. I saw that God had you in his hands all the way through this whole year. And so it's going to be a very good year for you no matter what. There's going to be enough money. There's going to be enough friends. There's going to be enough fun. There's going to be enough health. And there's going to even be that special person. There's going to be at least one or two special people that come into your life. So it's a pretty good year for you.
So far I feel like I got my personality back, my wit, my sense of humor is back for some reason.
Well, yeah, because everything is, you know, from that terrible thing, you've had a problem in the past health-wise, you know, just recently, and now your body's getting back, and you're going to feel better and better as they adjust that medication for you. Okay, so by the end of February, you'll be back better than you've ever been. So be happy with that. Thanks for calling in, Todd.
Yep.
All right, bye-bye. All right, and if you'd like a reading, feel free to give me a call at 1-800-555-5453 or 310-371-5444. All right, let's go to our herb of the week. Herbs are natural medicine that need to be treated with knowledge and respect, and we're going to do one that I use all the time. I cook with it, I smudge with it, I don't use perfume with it, but I do use it for if I have a stuffy nose and I need to clear my lungs, I use essential oil of sage. And that's what it is. Sage. That's right. And it was traditionally associated with longevity. And sage has a reputation for restoring failing memory in the elderly. Okay, well, maybe that's why I sniff sage oil all the time. I don't want my memory to fail. Don't fail me now. All right. But like other memory-enhancing herbs, it's also planted on graves. That's right. It was said that when the British started importing tea from China, the Chinese so valued the sage herb, they would trade 2 cases of tea for 1 of dried English sage. That's right. There's a purple variety, and that's generally used in medicine, and it's more effective than the common green plant. And in China, the root of a related plant called Dan Shen is used as a tonic herb. Now, the leaves are particularly used, and they have a special affinity with the mouth and throat, so it makes an ideal gargle or mouthwash. It's also very drying and very estrogenic. So they're useful in both for menopausal problems and when children, you know, when you're weaning children. The root in China, the Dan Shen, is mainly used for moving blood where there is stagnation, as in some types of menstrual pain and heart condition. And also it's very sedative and cooling, so it helps to reduce heat, particularly in the heart and the liver. Now, there are some cautions to avoid with sage, and you have to avoid therapeutic doses in pregnancy, but although small amounts of sage used in cooking are quite safe. And only take Dan Shen where the condition is caused by blood stagnation. Sage contains a chemical which can trigger fits in epileptics who should avoid the herb. So if you're epileptic, try not to do sage, okay? Now, I can remember many years ago, and I still do it, but there's a ritual when you go and pick your own sage. And of course, you know, you use sage for protection. You know, you can use sage wands for protection and clearing the air. They used it for funerals in the old days and for protection. And basically, it's really interesting. There is a male plant and a female plant, and there's a difference in smell in both of those plants and difference in uses. And I used to go with an Indian shaman, and we used to pick sage once a month in the throughout the summer. You know, you had to go. There was a specific time, and that you had to do it with a particular moon. And then you would go, and you would have tobacco. And what you would do is you would go through, and you would pull the plant. And if the plant wanted to go to you and it broke off, it was yours. If it gave you any resistance, you were to leave it alone. And before you were to, you know, before or after, I can't quite remember, you would give a pinch of tobacco as an offering to the plant, as a thank you, as a grace or whatever. And then you would take them and dry them upside down and then bind them together in wands. And then you would take cotton thread, depending on what you wanted to do with it. You would use a white cotton thread, completely cotton thread for protection. You would use a green thread, cotton thread for, for healing. And then you'd use a purple for spiritual and blue for mind problems. And that's how I would do that. And then I would make them and use the wands. And then you can use the sage wands to clear your area and clear you and from any kind of negativity. So there you have it, a little bit about sage. We're going to take a break, but we'll be right back, so stay with us.
Uplifting Talk, HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Linda McKenzie Show, and I'm glad that you're here. You're important to me. If you feel like you want a reading, feel free to call me at 1-800-555-5453, 310-371-5444. I know a lot of you say, well, we like what you're talking about. We want to listen to that. I said, yeah, that's okay, but, you know, you're important too, so feel free. If you need me, I'm here for you, okay? Other than that, you might be listening to something I'm saying, and maybe that will help you too. So that's the purpose of this show, and this whole network is to help you, and help you be positive and happy and healthy, and we can do it. We can choose happiness in every moment. Every moment we can do that. We have to be recognizing that. But when you start to feel down, look up and say, I'm choosing happiness. All right? Well, right now, let's get to our gemstone of the week. Gemstones have energies, and by carrying or wearing a stone, you may be able to amplify your own energy to help increase what you desire. Today, we're going to talk about rose quartz. And rose quartz actually emanates a calming, cooling energy that works on all the chakras to gently remove negativity and reinstate loving, gentle forces of self-love. So when you're feeling down and you're really hard on yourself, go grab yourself a wonderful piece of rose quartz. It provides that message that there's no need to for haste in any situation. It helps you to bring to you calmness and clarity of the emotions, and restores the mind to harmony, especially after chaotic or crisis situations. Now, rose quartz is especially helpful for any locations of the heart and the crown chakras. It's been known as a stone of gentle love, and it brings peacefulness and calm to relationships. It promotes receptivity to beauty, art, music, and the written word. Also, it enlivens imagination and represents a young, warm love. It also can be used to spiritually attune you to the energy of love, okay? So it reminds you to keep in love no matter what you're doing, and that's what helps the world, you know. And it also provides for the balance of yin-yang energy, and it's really very helpful in treating conditions related to emotional body, you know, balancing love emotions. It helps act as a rejuvenating agent for both the physical body and the emotions to kind of balance those out. So, and it's one of the most best stones in the world for healing emotional wounds. So if somebody's hurt you or you're not, and it doesn't matter, you know, where the love's coming from, child, parent, lover, husband, you know, friend, if you're hurt emotionally for love, it's an excellent stone to help you understand and get over that and figure it out. That, now the actual crystals are very rare and very small, and they are, just very, very, wonderful stone, this rose quartz. Now, in healing, rose quartz can be used to clear fluids from the cells of the body and to promote the release of impurities in the body. It can be used to enable the opening of the heart center, allowing to dissolve stress and tension. It's been used in the treatment of vertigo. It provides for help in diminishing disorders of the kidneys and adrenal glands. It can be used as an elixir to clear the skin, and is said to reduce wrinkles and to provide the wearer with a soft complexion. Now, what's an elixir? What you do is you make sure that the rock is very clean. You can sometimes rinse it off in salt water and energize it in the sun, or you can rinse it off in a stream or in the ocean, and then you let it dry in the sun if you want a strong male energy, or in the moon for a very feminine energy. And then you take that rock and then you put it in water. Okay, and you let it stay 24, 48 hours, however long that you feel, and then you will use that water to put on that skin, okay? That's what an elixir is. A lot of times it can be used to drink, but you have to, of course, understand what stones you're working with, because some of the stones, you know, you may not want to drink because it may not be very good for you, okay? So, also, you can place the rose quartz on your heart chakra, and it can diminish pain and actually stimulate the proper functioning of the heart, okay? If you place it on the area of the thymus, it's decreased coughs and soothed the bronchial and lung areas of the body. And it also has been used to diminish burns and to relieve and vanquish blistering due to heat, you know, where you get, you burn yourself and you get blisters. So that's a little bit about rose quartz. That's a pretty, nice stone that's available in most places. And you can, you know, almost everywhere you can get a rose quartz at a metaphysical store or in gem shops or whatever, or even online. Now it's easier to get some of the stones. It's easier, though, if you really go to the store and you run your hand over a bunch of rose quartz and find one that feels right or that you're magnetically attracted to. It will be much more easier for you to use and much more stronger in for you because it's got an affinity for you. Okay, so and here's another thing. You know, if you think that the stone has to, if the stone is polished with nail polish or it's very, very bright, you know, glittery, you have to ask if it's polished with clear nail polish. If it is, the stone is not going to work as well as a raw stone. And here's another thing that you probably don't know. The stone doesn't have to be picture perfect. It doesn't have to be the best stone in the box, okay? I know I picked a smoky quartz, and people said, why are you picking that? That's all broken and all sorts of stuff. And I said, you know why? Because it's good for me. And you know that smoky quartz and I, we've helped a lot of people, okay? So, you know, whatever you feel is the correct one. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back.
All positive natural health programs on HRNradio.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Linda McKenzie Show, and I want to say thank you for listening. If you'd like to drop me a line, you can send an email to info@healthylife.net. February 1st, I'm having a healing circle. It's going to be 7:30 to 9:30 Pacific time. It's going to be in Redondo Beach, and you can call me for the location. You can go to my Facebook page on Linda McKenzie Facebook page, and it gives you the information. There'll be a free psychic question and a healing meditation, and to work on your mind, body, and spirit issues. We've been having quite success with that, so feel free to do that. Until next time, this is Linda McKenzie, wishing you a week of grace, gratitude, and advancement. Bye.